1, 2, 3.
Just give me patience. Yeah.
What up, Z fam? It's your boy Z Dog MD, and I got a real doctor here. Not just a real doctor, but a professor of medicine and endocrinology at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, some kind of fancy pants clinic, that is a specialist in obesity and is gonna share his knowledge with us. He's done amazing things, sits on the national panel for...
recommendations for evaluation management of obesity.
In other words, the government telling you you're fat. Dr. Michael Jensen.
Thank you.
Good to see you, man.
Good to see you.
You're in town for what sounded to me like the most boring conference I've ever heard of, the American Society of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition.
Yeah.
Is it really boring, or?
You have to have a taste for it. Once you have the taste for it, it's no longer boring.
I'm going to be honest with you, Mike. I have a taste for TPN that cannot be sated. I used to call it total parenteral nougat when I was a resident, and nobody got it at all. They were like, I don't understand what you're saying, especially the pharmacists. But you got into obesity as a sort of subspecialty in your endocrine field. Why were you interested in that?
You know, it's hard to know, because I thought when I was a medicine resident that there was probably nothing more boring than diabetes. And then I got to be an endocrinology fellow, and I thought, oh, there can't be anything more boring than obesity. But then my division chair said, you know, really, if you don't know a lot about it, everything is boring. You need to learn about it, and I think you'll find that it's interesting. And he said, the other thing is, it's a really common problem that nobody knows how to deal with. This is 1984, 85.
Yeah.
And he goes, if you want to contribute, find a common problem that nobody knows much about and just study it as best you can.
And that's obesity.
And that was obesity in 1985.
This idea of like stuff being interesting when you learn more about it. So Tom is really fascinated by Bitcoin and knows a lot about it, and I'm bored to tears by it. Tom tried to teach me about it, and I'm still bored to tears by it. So the more you learned about obesity, though, the more you went down a rabbit hole that became kind of your life's work. I mean, what's your subspecialty in obesity?
So I'm trying to understand why fat tissue in some people causes you to be gravely ill. Mm-hmm. And in other people, they seem to live in harmony with a lot of extra fat for 90 years. And we think we're getting closer to understanding why that is, but it's still kind of a mystery, and it has huge treatment implications. If you can understand why some people's fat is making them sip and other people's is not, then you open up a whole new possibility of treatment.
Would you consider, just from just observation alone, would you consider Logan a healthy fat or a sickly fat?
Yeah, just eyeball him, Mike. Like,
his stomach is hidden behind the desk over there. I can't really comment.
I will say this: it's mostly abdominal obesity, and I'm convinced it's highly inflammatory and metabolically active. But that's just me. I'm uneducated, Mike. Well, so here's a serious question: how can you sort of get a sense of, is somebody fit and fat, which is a thing people talk about? Well, no, you know what? Having a little fat might live a little longer. You're protected against certain things like death in some studies that they report in the popular press. Versus, no, having that extra fat in particular places is inflammatory or leads to diabetes or other complications that can shorten your life. I mean, how would you distinguish?
So that easiest way we do it is we can measure people's stomach circumference and their hip circumference, and that gives you a much better predictor of what the likelihood they're going to have metabolic illness is than just knowing their weight. Now, once you get beyond a certain weight, it kind of doesn't matter where you've got it.
Because you're so big,
your health is going to suffer.
Right.
But for people who are just in the low end of the obese range, something like that, just overweight range, that knowing what the waist is and what the hips are gives you a lot of additional information about how likely they are to get diabetes, get hypertension, get high lipids, all that stuff.
So Trump, who is by far the healthiest president in the history of presidents, is going to live to 473. Even though his weight is high, his doctors have said, well, you know, he's carrying it on a tall frame and he's metabolically looking good. Is that feasible?
It's feasible. I mean, you'd need to know what his triglycerides are and his glucose is and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, and when you wear suits like that all the time, you really can't tell where somebody's carrying it. So
yeah.
It is possible that if you work out like crazy, you can carry extra fat and have it not be as damaging as if you're sedentary. The problem is if you work out like crazy, it's hard to maintain that much extra fat, especially if you're a guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So this fat and fit, partially true, but not completely true. I mean, if you're really centrally obese, you're still going to have trouble.
Yeah, so Winnie the Pooh is screwed because he's fat and he's eating honey. How much is sugar and carbohydrates? I mean, this is such a controversial thing. Anytime we talk about it, we get hate on both sides of the aisle because people are emotionally passionate about diet and the metabolic consequences of diet. Obesity, diabetes, heart disease, etc. Where do you fall in this whole spectrum? Like, are you Mr. Low Carb or High Carb, or do you think it depends on the patient?
So here's what I don't like about sugar, and I especially don't like about sugar-sweetened beverages, is if you sit there and you have your burger and fries and a 700-calorie giant Coke, you're not going to eat any less of that burger and fries than if you had water. And so sugar somehow, the sugar-sweetened beverages, and it doesn't matter whether it's fruit juice or pop or whatever, goes right past the built-in things we have that make us feel full.
Yeah.
And so essentially, people are getting those extra calories with no additional benefit. No, that they're not feeling that satisfaction
yeah.
from eating. And so over the course of, you know, a year or 5 years, you can imagine the huge number of extra calories you're getting because you don't turn down. It's not like you eat 500 calories less of that burger because you had a 500-calorie Coke.
Right, right. It doesn't add value in terms of getting full and stopping you from eating. It's just extra calories,
plain and simple. Calories.
With no other nutritional value.
Correct.
Unless phosphoric acid is considered a nutritional.
It deletes calcium right out of your bones.
It deletes calcium. So you have too much calcium in your bones, which is a common problem these days. And by the way, I want to thank you for being a member of the Z-Pack. So Z-Pack, you got to understand something, that a Mayo Clinic professor of medicine and researcher watches our show, okay? Deal with it, Oz. He's not watching Dr. Oz, okay? He can't say that because he don't want to be mean to a colleague. I don't consider you a colleague, Oz. Okay, also I'm watching you. And also I watch you because you're handsome. I don't watch you. Or do I? Anyway, so a question that my audience has is a calorie a calorie a calorie? So are 9, you know, calories from fat the same as 9 calories from carbs, the same as 9 calories from protein, or does the source of your calories change your metabolism in a way that can promote disease and obesity depending on the source?
A calorie is a calorie in terms of what your body can do with it for energy, but in terms of preferential use, if you're getting your calories from protein, it's most likely to be used to replace proteins that you're losing for just that natural turnover of body protein. Mm. All things being equal, if you're in a nutritionally balanced state, fat and carbohydrate are virtually equal because your body is great at burning both of those things. And if you get more, you take in more sugar, it will tend to burn more sugar. Mm. If you take in less sugar, it'll burn more fat. And so most of us are pretty good at that shift back and forth between fat, sugar, fat, sugar, fat, sugar. We do that all day, every day.
Right. So as an endocrinologist, and you also deal with lipid disorders and things like that, what's your take on sort of some people's arguments that are lipid disorders, low high triglycerides, metabolic syndrome, are less about saturated fat and more about refined carbohydrates?
Oh, I mean, there's a huge genetic background to this. So how you respond to food is driven a lot by your genes in that area, and it's partially driven by whether you're overweight or not.
Huh.
So it is true that if you feed people a lot of carbohydrate, you will raise, there is a large group of people that if they eat too much carb, even if they don't gain weight, it'll raise their triglycerides.
Uh-huh.
But there's a group of people that tends to be lower body obese, that if they eat a lot of carb, their triglycerides don't budge.
So you're talking about lower body meaning hips butt,
and thighs.
Hips and thighs, not belly.
Not belly. If the people with a big belly switch from sort of a modest carbohydrate to a high carbohydrate diet, you'll drive up their triglycerides.
Yeah. So there's something about your
even if they don't gain weight.
Right. So here's a question. Could it be that it's that genetic subtype that actually promotes the deposition of fat in the specific locations that are more harmful. And it's that same group that would have a triglyceride rise with carbohydrates.
We don't know that. I mean, there is definitely something about the characteristics of people's fat cells and your ability to make new fat cells or to be resistant to making new fat cells, in healthy new fat cells, that seems to underlie a lot of the stuff that we're finding. And there's some really good investigators understanding it at the real basic level. Why is this person's fat cell different than this person's fat cell? Yeah. And we tend to be looking at the precursors to fat cells that will become your new fat cells.
In other words, Logan's Big Mac, because that's the most common precursor to fat cells. So this is interesting. So all fat cells are not created equal.
Not at all.
There's healthy fat cells and unhealthy fat cells. And then there's brown fat cells, which the babies have. Yeah. Some adults have too, right?
They do. There's not much.
Not much? No. I have a lot. Being Indian, all my fat is brown. So here's a question. You have two different types of fat, and part of your research is trying to figure out, okay, what are you trying to tease out between the two?
We're trying to figure out why some fat cells just do not turn off when they should turn off. So fat is, I mean, if we didn't have fat cells, you'd die every time you eat a high fat meal because you couldn't get rid of it. It'd build up in the bloodstream. You'd get pancreas inflammation and die. But fat cells do a great job of just sucking up fat that you have in your diet and turning off the release because you don't need it. And then when you've digested that food, now it's been 5 hours that you ate, now they're sending fat back out. And there are some people, and it's the people who gain weight here, where they're not that good at sucking up that fat, and they're really not that good at stopping it from coming out. And so there's something fundamentally going wrong with those cells.
But here's a question. So there's been a shift in our population in where people are storing fat in terms of some of the data that you've seen. Tell us about that and why that might be.
So, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, there was sort of a population, there's this range of where we store fat, and it was pretty evenly distributed from people who would store it mostly in the hips and thighs versus people who stored it just predominantly in the abdominal area. And over 30 or 40 years, when we look at these broad population surveys where they measure people's waist and they measure their hip, there's been a trend towards a higher percent of the population storing it in the abdominal area, and there's really no good explanation for why that would occur. The best guesses are the things that have changed over the last 30, 40 years is we're more sedentary, and maybe the shift in, as you kind of alluded to, maybe it's too much carbohydrate. That's what some people think. But there's really not great evidence on any way to say why this is happening.
We don't know, in other words. And one thing we do know, it's not genetic drift. In other words, our genes are the same.
Correct.
Yeah. So that's one thing we can hold constant. It's something in our environment that's changed. Similar to, like, why are we seeing more allergies? You know, there's a lot of environmental components. Now, I think where that breaks down is people saying, well, we're seeing more autism. We're probably diagnosing autism more. So that's where we have to be very careful about environmental triggers and things like that. One of the questions I would have too, and is really, you actually clinically see patients who are obese and you try to help them lose weight. If I were coming in, let's say Logan's coming in and he's moderately obese, how would you start working him up and deciding what's a plan for him? Is there a one size fits all, like in the movie What the Health? They want everyone to be on a vegan diet and that will cure everything that ails us. Is that the answer, or what do you think about this?
So from the diet perspective, I was actually on the panel that did the national guidelines for obesity.
Oh, wow.
And so...
So you're paid off by Monsanto?
By the government.
Oh, which is basically just big Monsanto as far as I'm concerned.
So essentially what we looked at is all the studies that compared every diet, vegetarian, Mediterranean, you name it, there's been studies on it. If you look at the responses, it's exactly the same. The mean weight loss is the same no matter what diet. Now, what we don't know is maybe it's because there's a proportion of people that do really well on a low-fat diet, but it's always a some proportion, and so it sort of depends upon your ability to stick with that over the long run, to change eating habits over the long run, and some people maybe just hate low-fat diets. And other people hate low-carb diets. Mm-hmm. And so if they're telling them to do that, they're going to fail. And so what we try to do is go with what we think is the most reasonable approach, but then not give up if people can't do it with one and another.
To
be willing to be flexible until you find something that people they like and they can stick with, and they're losing the weight they want to lose.
Right. So it seems like, if you're going to look at evidence and trials, it seems like the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, seem to have the most suggestive evidence. And none of these trials are great. But am I wrong to think that they have the most suggestive evidence to be the best benefits for, say, cardiac risk?
Yeah, obesity? So in terms of improvements in the predictors of cardiac risk, the lipids and stuff like that, the DASH and the Mediterranean are definitely have the more positive effects on lipids.
Right. And here's a question. So, The Biggest Loser, this show on TV.
Oh my God, I love that show, Z. That's my favorite show.
Tom watches a lot of TV, like an unusually high amount, and then he tells me about it. He's like, Z, you gotta see the show, The Biggest Loser. These guys are really big, and then they get small, but then they gain all the weight back.
Yeah.
And here's the question, these
Plus,
guys lose.
I have a crush on Jillian Michaels, but then I found out she was a lesbian, so. Hope's that.
So, Jillian Michaels aside, these patients, these contestants on The Biggest Loser, lose a lot of weight very quickly in these sort of boot camp conditions. And then they find, looking in follow-up, that they gain it back and more. Mm-hmm. What's the mechanism there? What's going on?
So there's two thoughts. One of them is that we just have this point that we're set at, right? So that you can take somebody, you can make them gain weight, you can make them lose weight, and they eventually kind of end up back where they started.
Yeah.
And it's the one thought is this biological, that there's something that changes. My take on it is, it's a set point. It's the set point between you and your environment. So if you look at, for example, if you look at people exact same age, sex, everything else, who stay in the military versus who retire from the military, who gains weight?
The retirees.
Even though they're aging at the same rate, they're doing everything else at the same rate. A lot of the explanations of saying, oh, it's a set point. What's the set point if you're living in the same place, doing the same work, eating the same food? Of course you're going to weigh the same.
Yeah.
Or you're going to gain as we get older. But this idea that you're forced biologically, everybody's forced to do this, just can't. There's too many exceptions to that rule for me to believe it's an absolute rule.
Right. So let me unpack that a little bit more. So what you're saying is it's the interaction between our own biology and our environment that leads to our ultimate weight.
Yeah.
And one of those things is malleable, your environment, in terms of what you do, your exercise, what you put in your body, those kind of things. The other thing may be malleable with medications or future therapy, but is not necessarily malleable off the bat. So the thing you can control, you should try to control to the best effect to optimize for you.
Yeah.
Which again comes back to this, there's no one size fits all approach for obesity.
And that's why when we actually work with people who want to lose weight, one of the things we say, are you willing to look at your environment, to look at the triggers and cues and what's you know, why do you never go to the gym when you said you're going to go to the gym? Why are you always snacking in front of the TV when you said you're never going to snack? You have to understand a lot of the choices you can make are only what's there.
Yeah.
If you can change your choices by changing your environment, all of a sudden it becomes a lot easier.
Okay, so now I want to kick this into overdrive because you're triggering these questions that I've had for a long time that I'm quite passionate about. You had mentioned something about the environment sort of helping you make choices. Do we have willpower? Is that a thing?
We do. Yeah, no, absolutely we do.
Okay, how so? Like, are we in control of our choices, or is it entirely environmental influences that cause us to make these choices?
So, a lot of people don't recognize what it is in the environment that is driving their choices. Once you recognize what that factor is, you can take steps to get rid of that. I would call that free will, right?
Yeah.
It's your willpower. I mean, if I could invent a willpower pill, then I'd be rich.
Sure.
But what I tell people is, why do you want to fight this willpower thing every day when if you can just learn what it is that's driving your behavior and make changes so that it's easier for you to do what you say you want to do, then why not do it that way? Why fight the willpower bear every day?
And I'm in full agreement. I think that willpower is this idea of overcoming our elephant, our unconscious sort of conditioning. Why is the elephant the way it is? It's been conditioned by environment, by education, by belief, somewhat by genetics, by biology. Don't mess with it. It's big. Okay, respect it. So change the path. Change the path that you're walking on, and don't overwhelm the little guy on top who thinks he's in control of the elephant. If you give him a lot of data, he's going to be paralyzed. He's going to take the easy way out and listen to his elephant and have a chocolate bar, or grab that high carb meal that's available here with all the processed sugar, or the high fat McDonald's burger, whatever it is. So if we can actually change the education process, the environment, the triggers. Uniquely for each person, ideally,
right.
But as a society as a whole, and then people will get into this nanny state idea. Well, you took the sugar out of our...
But I mean, obesity is a public health problem. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to solve this problem for the U.S. by going to the doctor.
Right.
There are just, A, not enough doctors who know about it. And even if there were, it would be horrifically expensive.
Right.
So why not develop some rational public health approaches and that help people understand this problem? It's important. And then the benefits of being physically active and more moderation in diet. I mean, we did this for smoking.
Yeah.
Right? We had a nice public health thing, and the smoking rates went way down.
Yeah. So now Tom just vapes.
We did it for seatbelts.
Way doper.
We did it for seatbelts. You're right. Yeah.
And nobody called it a nanny state.
Some people did.
I'm going to die in a car crash because
I can't get out.
The car's going to be on fire. I can't get out.
Yep. Just like vaccines, we have a public health campaign that gets everybody vaccinated. We have herd immunity. It's good for everybody. But, something about diet, there's a religion around diet. Right? What's the most common resistance you face when a patient comes in and you're trying to look at their situation?
So the most common question I'm going to ask is, I want to lose weight.
Yeah.
And I would say, okay, are you willing to change your eating and activity habits in order to accomplish this over the long run? Mm-hmm. Are you willing to make permanent changes in eating and activity if it will help you with your weight? Mm. And if they said, no, I just want a pill. Then you kind of know things are probably not going to go that well.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Are they not going to go well? So do we not have a pill that can cure obesity or make people skinny?
We don't.
Tapeworm Z.
You know what? That's probably the most medical thing Logan has ever said on the show. He's absolutely right. A tapeworm.
What do you think about Ray Kurzweil's idea that we're going to have sort of nano robotic sleeves that sort of just pass food through us in the future?
Well, there are operations that try to do that.
That was the second question.
And sometimes people do really well with it. But I'll tell you that most of my patients who do really well, they get religion.
Yeah.
So they see this change and they don't want to let it go. And they will do whatever it takes to keep that accomplishment.
Yeah.
But I have almost as many patients who say, no, this is going to do it for me. I can just keep doing what I want to do. And they end up in trouble. They end up either with nutritional problems or they gain back all their weight. So, I mean, as of yet, we do not have anything so powerful that some of my patients haven't found a way to get around it.
Methamphetamines? Smoking meth?
Well, the good thing is that any weight you lose, you'll probably never regain because you might die.
Oh, death is the best form of weight loss. That is the final comment.
At least you don't regain.
You don't regain the weight. That's true. That's true. This is interesting. So gastric bypass, gastric sleeve, those kind of things. Have they gotten safer over the course of your career, do you think?
Yeah, they're better. We do them now with the laparoscopes, so you don't have the big hernias afterwards. The actual effectiveness probably isn't any better, but they're safer. The risks are lower. People are out of the hospital sooner. That's if you go to a good center. Now, yeah. If you go to some of the, you know, fly-by-night places, those are the people that end up at Mayo Clinic, right. Hospitalized for months because things did not go well.
So you get what we used to call the GBGB patients, gastric bypass gone bad. And we would see them in the 90s and early 2000s, and they would come to tertiary centers like Stanford, Mayo, and I would consult as the medicine team and just be like, oh my gosh, leaks and fistulas.
Parenteral nutrition for months on end.
TPN, and you're an expert in TPN. You're managing the inpatient service there. And what would you want to tell people, like, as a takeaway, like the most important thing you've kind of learned in all of this, in your career, which has been long and illustrious in managing obesity?
So people are not gonna lose weight if they don't change their eating habits. They're probably gonna regain that weight if they don't change their activity habits. So diet change is very good at helping people lose weight.
Yeah.
But if that's all you do, you have a 90%+ chance of regaining all that weight back. People who change their diet and then become intentionally more physically active, or they're forced to because of their job or whatever, are much more likely to keep that weight off for the long run, because now it doesn't matter that you're 40 pounds less.
Yeah.
You're burning the same number of calories as when you were 40 pounds heavier. And that's sort of what the body's trying to do, is say, well, I'm used to burning 3,000 calories a day. You lose weight, now I'm only burning 2,500. I want to go back to 3,000.
Yeah.
And so the only way you can go back to that is regain that weight or do 500 calories of extra activity throughout the day, walking, whatever your trick is.
But, and so that's a key point, is like you can lose the weight with diet, but then you're not going to keep it off without changing your activity level.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be as simple as walking, like you said.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't have to be, you know, CrossFit and, you know, whatever it is that Tom does that hurts his back every time he does it.
Deadlifts, bro.
What'd you say, Logan?
Deadlifts.
what do you think about activity trackers like the Fitbit and the Apple Watch, those kinds of things?
So those have been a real boon for us in terms of understanding what the people who we're working with are actually doing. Mm. You know, before we had this, every single person I saw walked at least 5 miles a day.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say, well, like, are you? Oh, yeah, you know, I'm this. I do a lot of walking. Now that we've got our phones do it, Fitbits do it, everything, I say, well, let's just take a look. Oh, 3,000 steps a day. That's not so much.
Yeah. So you're That's holding people so accountable.
So actually what I try to do is help them hold themselves accountable. Because if you're just accountable to me, it's easy to say, oh, I'm just not going to go see him again.
Right.
But if you're accountable to yourself, if you set your own goals.
Right.
Then it's much easier to stick with that.
Got it. So you don't see it as a quit bit? They don't just throw it away after a while?
Some people do.
Yeah.
You know, for some people it's a gimmick. Others will check it like every night.
Yeah.
And what I tell them is don't wait till nighttime. It's too late then.
Yeah.
If you're not on track, you better know it by lunchtime.
Yeah.
If your goal is 10,000 steps and you're at 2,000,
yeah,
do something that afternoon.
So what do you think of these people who are slinging like tea and supplements and things like that for weight loss? Any of it work, or is it all BS?
It's a gimmick, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes people do well with gimmicks. Most of the time they don't.
Is it a placebo gimmick?
I mean, it probably is. You know, if it doesn't cost a lot and it helps you, I'm not going to make a big stink about it.
Right.
But if it's risky, dangerous, costly, then I'd say, you know, we really need to rethink this.
Tapeworms.
Tapeworms.
Right.
So, you know, there are half a dozen medications now that are out there. None of them are very effective on their own, but there is a better acceptance now that in the right person who's making all the efforts and needs a little bit of extra help, that we're seeing some benefit from those. Whereas if you're just sitting in the office writing prescriptions, there's probably no benefit.
No benefit. That's a key component. You have to have the motivation. You know what I find? I've been trying to meditate a lot lately, which is a hard thing to do, because the hardest part of it is setting a conscious intention before you sit down that this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend an hour paying attention to my breath, and that's what I'm doing it for these reasons. But if you don't set that intention and you sit down, I'm going to meditate, it devolves into daydreaming.
Oh,
and
exactly.
Wasting your time.
Yep.
The same sounds like it's true in any endeavor that involves quote unquote conscious willpower. And that includes weight loss. If you don't have a strong intention, motivation, you're not going to succeed. So the pills might help you, it sounds like, if you have that intention and you have support. But if you're just taking it and you think it's a magic cure like everyone in America, you're going to fail. Fair enough to say?
Yep.
Yeah.
But this is America, damn it. I want a pill. I want to eat McFlurries and take a pill and be skinny. Isn't that what you guys do?
Can you help Tom Heineberg?
If I could, I would be able to buy the Mayo Clinic.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, just the cost of buying Epic alone is going to kill you. Here's a question. Tom is the biggest loser, and not of weight.
Bottom line, I got to ask it. How many times a day should we eat Chipotle? Two, three, four? What's your advice, Doc?
Do you have a Chipotle deficiency? You might need to go to like 8.
Here's a question.
Medical doctor from the Mayo Clinic just told me that, people. You all saw it.
Well, you don't understand.
Professor of medicine.
He's a professor of medicine, but he also is in Big Chipotle's pocket. because
hurry, I need to buy some stock.
Because total parenteral Chipotle, or TPC, is something that we often offer, especially for our pancreatitis patients, because you need to feed them early and often. And a high Chipotle parenteral feed.
You know, they changed that to CPN, Central Parenteral Nutrition, but we could call it Chipotle Parenteral Nutrition.
Oh, wow. Chipotle Parenteral Nutrition. Wait a minute. Did they really change it to CPN?
Yeah.
It's not TPN anymore?
Not anymore. In the hospital. It's because we still try to get people to eat, so it's not total. So we call it central because it has to go in the central vein. So
you guys,
we're trying to make it really difficult to keep the field closed.
What I like to do is I like to use the lingo that's about roughly 7 years out of date, no matter what.
TPN.
TPN.
Yeah, go for
it. I'm gonna roll with TPN. Exactly. I'm still using the DSM-4. What's the best part about working at an integrated academic place like Mayo?
So the best thing is it doesn't matter how difficult a patient I've got, how rare their condition, I can call for help and there's somebody there who's the world expert in that and they're gonna make me look good.
That's dope. And of course they're calling you too. They're saying, hey,
is this patient obese or not?
Yeah. I need a diagnostic help. This patient's 700 pounds. Obese? Let me do a formal consult.
Fortunately, my diagnosis isn't so difficult. It's the treatment part that gets to be the challenge.
That's where it's hard. And here's actually another question about a group like Mayo, because you guys are actually on the forefront, salaried physicians.
Yes.
There's no incentive for you to do stuff to people.
Correct.
Does that work in real life?
For the most part, it does. So, for example, our surgeons are not going to operate on somebody that doesn't need it just because they'll get paid, because they get paid the same no matter what. So they feel completely comfortable saying, no, you do not need an operation for this. And it's the same thing with most of the other, for those of us who do thinking specialties, it doesn't really affect us.
Right.
But for people who are doing things to people, it affects them, because you can always convince yourself, maybe I really don't know, maybe I really should do this test. And by the way, it doesn't hurt that I get paid money to do that test. Whereas if you get paid the same no matter what, it's what's in the patient's best interest.
Yeah, I'm actually a big believer in that. We did that at Turntable. Everybody was salaried. It wasn't about RVUs or generating productivity. How has the EHR affected your practice?
There's been some good things and some bad things. Mm. When I started at Mayo, it was all paper records.
Mm.
You could wait 4 hours for that record to show up from their previous appointment, and in the meantime, nothing is happening.
Right.
Then you'd wait another 3 hours to get their x-rays up.
Yeah.
Now, the patient walks in, everything is there.
Yeah.
It's completely ready.
Yeah.
It makes it so much better. And plus, I can pull information in from all over the place now.
Are you too siloed, though? So do you not talk to your colleagues anymore? Is it all staff messages?
That's become a problem. Mm. Again, when I first started, we'd have what we call off the floor. So I'd have somebody that I thought, chest pain, I'm not sure if this is angina, and the cardiologist would come on and see the patient with me and say, I think this is this because of this. And I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And plus, I made a lot of friends.
Right.
And now it's like, send them off, you get back this electronic note and you really don't know. And if you call them, they don't answer and da, da, da. So it's had its positives, but it's also had its negatives in terms of that personal interaction.
I found the same thing. It's sort of a health 2.0 trying to evolve into 3.0. And the 3.0 will be when we get back into the room and stop looking at the computer. And the computer just automates everything that can be automated.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we can use AI and we can use those adjuncts, but really it's about not just this with our patients, but this with you and me as colleagues.
Yeah.
Like, I've learned so much sitting here with you. I can't imagine. I hope our audience has as well. But, you know, I want to thank you deeply for taking time out of your conference schedule, coming here, being a fan of the show, and then actually sharing your wisdom with us on one of the biggest problems public health is facing currently, which is obesity.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Michael Jensen.
Thank you.
Really,
it was a pleasure.
Doctor.
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 God, I hate you so much, Tom Heimer.
How many McFlurries can I eat a day?
12.
This is what I have to deal with every day, Mike.
Are you doing an overfeeding experiment?
These two assholes have been doing an overfeeding experiment since I met them, let me just tell you. And they try to feed me. They're always like, come to lunch, Z. Where are you going? Oh, we're going to Zapato's. We're going to have a big-ass burrito filled with rice. I'm like, ah.
Listen, these guys with their fancy medical talk call it an overfeeding experiment. I call it treat yourself. You know what I'm saying?
We out.
Just give me patience. Yeah.